You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jeff Bossert. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Henry Frain. You just heard the 1969 hit by the one-hit wonder Steam that became a theme song for the Chicago White Sox during the 1977 season. At Comiskey Park, organist Nancy Faust started playing the song. It would eventually catch on with fans, and it was played when opposing pitchers were pulled or when it was clear that the Southsiders had won a game. And it's since caught on in a number of sporting events, and I thought it was an appropriate theme to start out the program today. Our guest on the Afternoon Magazine, Mark Gonzalez, a sports reporter since the early 1980s. He's written for various publications, including the San Jose Mercury News, Arizona Republic, Sports Illustrated, and Baseball America. He's currently the White Sox beat reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Mark has combined various stories from his work as well as research into team history in his new book, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly: Heart-Pounding, Jaw-Dropping, and Gut-Wrenching Moments from Chicago White Sox History. Hello, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Before we start the show, I must, full disclosure here, I'm a Cub fan, but having done a number of programs on the Cubs and this segment before, I felt it was time to branch out a little bit. It was like talking about one major candidate for office or one political party with never mentioning the other party. So, and I grew up near Chicago, so I still recall a lot of what you discussed in this book, so I thought it was time for a Sox show. Talk about why you decided to write this book.
A triumph approached me. It took some time to get clearance to write the book, but I was kind of fascinated by it because, as you know, even being a Cub fan, the White Sox history has covered a lot of good, bad, and the ugly. And one of the things I found out in researching and writing the book was just how close the White Sox have come in the 60s and 70s, but not won a title or have anything to show for it. And they've been pretty competitive, but yet they haven't won that title or won a series of titles that they could latch on to, and therefore they share some misery with the Cubs in that regard.
Yeah, an acquisition there, or maybe somebody doesn't get hurt there or whatever, you might have more of a run like the Yankees or some other more prominent team.
Yeah, especially in the 60s, after coming off that American League title season in 59, there was a euphoria that, hey, this was going to be the start of something big. But, you know, trading youngsters that blossomed elsewhere and getting veterans that best days were behind them, that was a big chunk of why they didn't win more titles.
Yeah, they had something like, I want to say 1969, did I say in your book, something like 17 straight winning seasons or something along those lines.
Yeah, it's an amazing run, something I didn't realize thoroughly in researching this book. I grew up in the Bay Area, was a Giant fan before I started following the team and researching the fact that the Giants had four straight second-place finishes from 1965 to 1969. And you're talking about a 10-team division then, and our 10-team league then, so naturally you had a great shot at it and yet fall short, and then the White Sox were in the same boat.
Well, let's talk about this year's team, and we'll welcome your calls and questions, by the way, to Mark Gonzalez in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, or outlying 800-222-9455. If you have any questions about a particular player in Sox history, if you want to talk about this year's team, your calls are welcome. At the time I scheduled the show, it was about a month ago. The Sox were, I think, maybe five or six games out. They'd just traded for Jake Peavy, who was injured, but they thought would rehab quickly. And in a fairly tight race with the Tigers and Twins for the Central Division lead, what has happened the last month or so? What's gone wrong?
A lot of everything. Mostly it's been the offense that really hasn't supported the pitching. And when the offense has been good enough, the relief, late inning relief hasn't been there to really bridge the gap. It's almost been like the perfect storm when you combine those two factors with Jake Peavy not being able to return until last Saturday. Everybody thought that he'd be back by the end of August, and then Alex Rios just has not gotten untracked. Jermaine Dye has really had a second consecutive miserable second half. You add all those things up together, and this is what you get, a third-place team that's quickly fallen out of contention.
Yeah, they actually have a worse record than the Cubs, but have been closer the last maybe two, 3 weeks to actually still having a shot.
Yeah, and that fuels the frustration, the fact that the White Sox felt, hey, if we get on a good run, we finish the season with I believe, 6 of their last 9 games against the first-place Tigers. They felt they could control their own destiny if they got close enough. They've had numerous chances and have failed, so they have nobody to blame but themselves.
Jim Thome was dealt to the Dodgers around the time I scheduled this program, too. Does General Manager Kenny Williams, was he at all waving a white flag there, or are you just looking at it, giving a guy who's been a designated hitter the last few years a chance to play for a really good team, the L.A. Dodgers, and have a shot at a title?
Kenny will say it was more the latter, the fact that he owed it to Jim Thome to give him a better chance of reaching the postseason. I believe him in that regard, but I think there were other factors during that time. When he made the deal, they had lost, I believe, 7 of the last 9 when the trade was finalized, and he had other guys he was putting in the water to see if anybody would bite. Jose Contreras is one guy that they moved, but I think that he was willing to roll the dice and move some other big-ticket guys had there been offers out there.
Well, let's talk about Ozzie Guillen. I mean, I guess because he's led the Sox to a world championship and been such a personality, he came out as a rookie shortstop in 1985. And what kind of relationship did he have, or do you know how he stayed in touch with management over his years after playing, coaching for other teams that led him to become the White Sox manager?
You know, Ozzie's an interesting study in that he didn't come up originally through the White Sox. He was a San Diego Padre. In fact, one of my best friends growing up played with Ozzie at AAA in Las Vegas the year before he got traded to the White Sox. But Ozzie really grew as a White Sox. And I say that being as a player, the fact that Jerry Reinsdorf, the chairman, really took care of him, helped him with his finances. The fact that there were veterans that were on the White Sox when Ozzie was a rookie in 1985 that really helped him, kind of showed him how to be a ball player, not just making the right plays and hitting at the right time, but being mature on the field, not throwing your helmet after a strikeout, not hanging your head or kicking the dirt after making an error. These things really helped him go a long way as a White Sox player. When he did not come back, he was upset, took a shot at management, but that was it. I think the fact that the fans liked his style of play and that he did coach elsewhere really helped him become more seasoned to where he is right now as a manager.
Yet you have to mention about 15 or so run-ins. He either had confrontations with someone or I think more often just quotes for the media involving a number of players, coaches, umpires, broadcasters, many of them involving profanity, or at least a few, that, you know, I guess trying to put somebody in their place, or I guess the one that I can recall as a Cub fan, him telling off Rich Hill, a former Cub product, the starting pitcher who got shelled one day. I hate to say this, Ozzie being Ozzie, hate to quote like people saying Manny Ramirez being Manny, but that's just typical Ozzie?
Yeah, there's really no filter with Ozzie. There's no gray area. It's all black and white, and he's going to say what's on his mind with, you know, few exceptions. In the case of the Cubs, you know, the funny thing is he really likes the Cubs organization. He likes their players. He's friends with Carlos Zambrano. Derek Lee was a guy he coached in Florida, but he just does not like Wrigley Field, and he makes no secret of that. So it all becomes a big cloud, as you say, a big bomb, you know, like an atom bomb that explodes, because as Cub fans know, you know, Wrigley Field is sacred to them.
Do you ever feel he's been, I mean, following this day by day, in danger of losing his job? I think last year he called out Kenny Williams, so let's bring in some better hitters or something along those lines. I mean, has he ever, you know, been on the bubble?
I think that was one time where I don't think he was going to get whacked, but he was put on double secret probation, just the fact that he was frustrated. I think he was mad at his hitters, but he kind of put the onus on his hitting coach, Greg Walker, who is a big part of the White Sox family and one of Jerry Reinsdorf's favorites. And I think it was almost a case of him going too far. Now, of course, the White Sox tried to spin it on the media, but if you look at the words and what Ozzie said at the time, those were pretty harsh things he said, and those were something that me as a reporter, I couldn't overlook that. Those have to be documented. So I think that was one time where he was definitely put on notice there, but is certainly not going to be fired.
We're talking with Mark Gonzalez about his book, The Good, Bad, and the Ugly, Chicago White Sox. Welcome your calls at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You brought up the term family, White Sox family. How much does Jerry Reinsdorf have to do with that? I mean, being the main man for so long and staying in touch with not only people like Guillen, but you mentioned Greg Walker, former players that have come back as coaches or you know, helped out in some capacity.
I think it's pretty big that Jerry Reinsdorf, and he grew up in Brooklyn. He was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. It was almost like a community team where players lived in the community during the season and sometimes during the off season. Where fans and community members had an attachment to players. You know, it was almost like they were one of them and could live their lives through them. And I think that goes a long way with the White Sox. You see guys like Robin Ventura coming back. You know, Ron Kittle's a part of the community. Moose Skowron, whose association with the White Sox goes back to the 60s. Bill Melton, who's a member, you know, the White Sox alumni and is doing pre- and post-game shows for Comcast. He acknowledges those guys. He acknowledges the history, and it's impressive when you look at the fact that Jerry Reinsdorf didn't take over the White Sox until 1981, yet he recognizes the history and the players who made this franchise popular.
Well, let's go back a little bit and talk about the front office earlier. Bill Veeck is such a huge part of White Sox history, particularly guiding them through some financially difficult days and was really creative with his marketing budget. And I think he had him, you know, wearing shorts in 1976.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that because I was talking to David Schaefer, who used to be head of stadium operations at the White Sox, whose father was Rudy, was Bill Veeck's right-hand man. He'd talk about days when they would just sit around after games with a few beers and just come up with ideas to draw fans, and he talked about, you know, having an urban cowboy night when it was really big in the 70s. You mentioned the shorts as part of the uniform. That was a big promotion back then, and unfortunately for the White Sox, the anti-disco demolition night that really gained a lot of attention, a lot of it, you know, a negative, but it was something that put the White Sox on the map all the time. You know, Bill Veeck was always the guy kicking the tires to draw fans. You know, it was something they had to do then, but you got to give the guy a lot of credit for being resourceful.
Do you have a favorite promotion of all those you researched from among the Bill Veeck ideas?
The one research, and you know, I didn't know about the Urban Cowboy Night. I'm not a big country western fan, but that was one I remember was very, very popular back then. In those days, I lived in, you know, on the West Coast, but I remember how popular that song was and with the movie and all that, and how that took off. But the anti-disco demolition night, and working with Paul Sullivan, who happened to be a White Sox fan, who was in the visitor's dugout during the games of the doubleheader and sharing a bottle of refreshment with some friends before he got the bottle taken away from a Detroit coach. I mean, to talk to him and ask him to relive those moments, I found it pretty fascinating.
One point, not in your book, but I believe that Bill Veeck got, you know, Harry Carey was so associated with the Cubs, but is leading the seventh inning stretch, I believe, started in Comiskey Park.
Yeah, you know, it was funny too because you know, before the popularity of cable TV and such, you know, the White Sox were on I believe UHF station, but yet Harry was such an attraction back then, and I think really the Sox took a step backwards and when Harry left to go to the Cubs because you know, a lot of people watched the Cubs because of Harry, and I think that the same could be said for the White Sox and Harry's candidates up in the booth with Jimmy Pearsall.
When you talk about some of the other people in the front office, it seemed like Rowan Heeman accomplished a lot. You run through some of the general managers, and he mentioned his theory of scout, draft, sign, and develop. 135 trades involving more than 400 players in his 25 years with the Sox and then with the Orioles. And there's an award named after him. Do you remember what we call I don't know, the Roland Heeman Award is named for? Or?
Yes, I go back a ways with Roland, with the Diamondbacks. I knew him when he was a Baltimore general manager. Unfortunately, Roland declined an interview with a book that was nothing personal. It's just that Roland someday is going to write his memoirs. His association with baseball goes back a long, long way, starting with the Angels, which I mentioned in the book where he came from. But this is a man who really trusts the people under him, scouts, front office people. He helped blossom a lot of current GMs, you know, David Dombrowski of Detroit and guy in Cincinnati whose name, Walt Jocketty, were two guys off the top of my head, as well as Doug Melvin, the Brewers GM who lives in Chicago. Those are guys that he's really taken great pride in nurturing and making them executives. But Roland was a people person. He wasn't afraid to make deals. He really trusted his coaches, his managers, and scouts. And I think that's kind of a lost trait in baseball these days. And I think Roland deserved a lot of credit for getting the White Sox back to where they were when he went in 1972, when they really challenged Oakland, and then again in 77 with those Southside Hitmen.
And he was responsible largely for the 83 team.
Yeah, the 83 team. Boy, it's funny. You talk to a lot of these guys, you think they'd won the World Series, but it was a special team that year, the fact that they won so many games. They started off slow. Tony La Russa, it was kind of a make-or-break year for them, and they really took off with Rudy Law and Julio Cruz, top of the order, and Ron Kittle's breakout rookie year, Greg Walker, Harold Baines. It's a special group, and I know they had a reunion about 6 years ago, honoring that team, and Tony La Russa and Dave Duncan drove in that night just to be there with that group, and I'm sure it's special to a lot of the White Sox fans as well.
The 83 team, I'm somewhat familiar with them. I guess I turn them on occasionally. I remember the day they had won that division championship. Veteran leadership, speed, power, defense, but. Doug Rader, I guess, is he the one who coined the term winning ugly?
Yeah, he was with Texas then, and Richard Justice and Randy Youngman were working in Dallas at the time, and Rader had made the comment to one of them, and the other reporter was working the desk, and that quote got in, and it got a headline as well, and it really spread like a brush fire. Just the fact, they're winning ugly, which is like, how are they doing this? And, they just find ways to win. It ain't pretty. But the fact is they had quite the elements to win the division with the power and the speed and the pitching. Lamar Hoyt was a 20-game winner that year. And they were well-equipped.
I had forgotten, too, that Hawk Harrelson was a GM. I just think of him so much as a broadcaster for so long. I guess still talking about that around that time. Is there still an animosity towards him for letting go of Tony La Russa?
It's funny when you say that, because in 06, the Cardinals were playing an interleague series in Chicago, and of course, Tony has his share of boosters in Chicago, and that had come up about the whole Harrelson La Russa dynamic or lack of, and Tony had said that Hawk should have let him go sooner. That it's always something in baseball when a general manager inherits a manager, and sometimes they're not on the same page, and I think that was the case. But I also think it was a year of transition where the Roland Heeman era had kind of run its course. Hawk had some firm ideas about the way he wanted to run the organization. Tony was, a pretty headstrong guy. And the fact that they didn't get off to a good start pretty much sealed Tony's fate.
We are talking about a manager who bats the pitcher eighth, in the National League, to see that strugglers like Albert Pujols have a better chance of coming up with guys on base. And I seem to recall, you didn't mention in your book, that he had this strange theory for a while as manager of the A's where he would have every pitcher, he didn't have like the starter reliever normal program you stick to with your pitching staff. You'd have every pitcher throw like three innings.
He tried that briefly with Oakland, and it kind of lasted maybe about four games. But Tony wasn't a guy Tony isn't a guy that's he's not afraid to go outside the box now and then, as you mentioned, with the pitcher batting eighth at times, or splitting up the pitchers where they're throwing like three innings, or maybe the last guy throws two, then you bring in the closer if you got a lead. He wasn't afraid to think outside the box, and I think a lot of times it really helped his stature, just as a guy who wasn't afraid to go outside the cookie cutter.
I've been a huge fan of Steve Stone for years, you know, with his broadcasting career. Not too young to remember him as a player, but as a Cub fan, I tend to forget that these days in the booth, any days as a broadcaster, they wouldn't have been possible without the White Sox. And I guess it kind of seems like a natural that he would return to the South Side, although he, you know, left under not very good conditions when he resigned as a Cubs broadcaster.
Yeah, it's funny. He's mindful of letting people know that he's probably the only guy who's played for both teams and announced for both teams. But he's had a pretty good rapport with the White Sox. The fact that when he came back after his stint with the Cubs, that he came back and helped the White Sox, and was very grateful that Bill Veeck was fair with him during negotiations, and then to come back and announce for the White Sox. He's been very happy. I don't think he's had any what he'd perceive as interference from the front office. It's been an interesting landscape for him.
We're talking with Mark Gonzalez, the Tribune writer, whose book is now available, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Chicago White Sox. And if you're a Sox fan or just have curious about anything in White Sox history, feel free to call in at 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana or 800-222-9455. You had to include a chapter of the most, I guess, notable part of White Sox history, one of the most notable parts of White Sox history, the Black Sox scandal of 1919. And I think the quote that really stands out for me, you spoke with someone at the Baseball Hall and Fame Museum, and they said, and I'm not finding my question right in front of me, but he says it brings out emotions in people who come through that. Yeah, it evokes emotions in visitors. I guess you could also be have people thinking about what might have been had Shoeless Joe Jackson and all those others been able to continue their careers.
Yeah, I mean, they had fantastic players. They'd won the World Series a couple years earlier. The players felt that they weren't getting paid fairly. The reason why I talked to Jeff Idelson, the Hall of Fame, is because there's been so much documented on what happened in the Hall of Fame, but really I want to go one step further and just, you know, what's its place in history? Because right now, one of the hot topics regarding the Hall of Fame is whether players who have tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs should be admitted to the Hall of Fame. And I figured, well, let's take it, you know, one step further, because you have this gambling scandal, and it's part of history, and it is in the Hall of Fame, and just wanted to talk to Jeff about what people think about when they see this display, the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, because it is there, and unfortunately, in baseball history, it is a big black eye.
We can go back a little bit. We first talked about players in the 50s and 60s. You mentioned 1959. Are there unsung heroes on that team that maybe aren't getting their due? I think we need to hear names like Billy Pierce, but the pitcher. As we mentioned, really good teams in those days. But are they enshrined how they should be in Chicago sports history?
I think the fans that follow that team still remember a lot of the guys that were heroes. You know, the Jim Landises, the Jim Riveras. Those guys, you know, the fact that the late Ted Kluszewski was acquired late in the year, he was hurt, but he came through with some big hits down the stretch. Probably didn't supply the power that they thought, but they appreciated his contributions. And of course, you know, when they won the league title, and then the sirens that went off that night, a lot of people still remember that. It's kind of neat that there were so many elements in that season. You don't see a real signature moment because there were so many moments leading up to the actual clinching that it gives fans a lot to talk about.
Yeah, people thought there was an air raid or something going on because of the sirens and what time, what kind of era we were in.
Yeah. I mean, that's something you always wonder. You know, if people talk about where were you when Elvis died, and it's sort of like, well, what era were we in when the White Sox won the American League title in 1959? Well, you know, the fact that they won it kind of shifted everybody's minds away from the Cold War, what was going on, except when the sirens went off. So it kind of added a little bit of pop culture to this.
Let's talk about the first White Sox player to break the color barrier, Minny Minoso. We talked about Bill Veeck, and I believe another one of those Veeck sort of promotional type things was getting him to play in every decade.
Yeah, that didn't go over so well in the latter decades, but the fact that Bill Veeck was an innovator, the fact that Minoso was a very good player, and I think the fact that the White Sox were at the forefront of integrating their roster really helped them, not just being a better team, but just the acknowledge that there are good players in this world regardless of their color.
And there you have a whole chapter on international players. Of course, Ozzie Guillen, but we've also in more recent years had Asian players, Tadako Higuchi, Shingo Takatsu. The White Sox seem to be, I don't know if they're on the forefront in that area, but they've all, you know, also had Venezuelan players like Lily Aparicio and certainly have gotten involved in that foray with other teams.
Yeah, I mean, they're at the forefront, and I think more so now than ever, you see a lot of teams getting involved in foreign affairs, whether it be in the Dominican spending more money on bonuses or even, you know, paying attention to Cuban defectors. I think the White Sox went very far to really cultivate that area with, you know, acquiring Jose Contreras from the Yankees and what he did in the 2005 playoffs, and then getting Alexei Ramirez later, and now Diane Vicedo. Certainly they've paid a lot for Vicedo, but I don't think that would have been possible had they not had successes with Ramirez and Contreras. But once again, it speaks to their willingness to explore the international market.
Well, I guess this can lead into a discussion. We talked about 59 and 83. We really haven't talked about the world championship team in 05. I mean, bringing something we hadn't experienced since the Bulls won all those championships. And do you have is there a particular favorite moment from having worked that season, or some point maybe where you knew that this was going to be something special?
Yeah, there was a game in Baltimore around the trading deadline, and there was a lot of talk about the White Sox going out and getting Ken Griffey Jr. And at that time, the team had meshed very, very well. It didn't seem like they needed a big star. They went out and got Jeff Blum, who later hit a game-winning homer in Game 3 of the World Series. But at that time, they're involved in some brushback knockdown pitches with Baltimore. And A.J. Pruszynski got hit by a pitch. In the next inning, Mark Burley hit an opponent with two outs in the sixth inning, and Burley was ejected from the game, and it stopped in an impressive streak where I think he had thrown at least six innings and a bunch of starts. It was like going to be a major league record or whatever, but he was willing to sacrifice that to defend his teammates. And I thought that show of defense and teammate and all that really created a bond. They went on to win the game. They came from behind to win it. They had a 15-game lead. And I thought right then that this team is got something special going. And I thought that even though the lead was whittling away in September, I thought these guys had the equipment to go the distance.
I think maybe it was Paul Konerko. I can't remember the player, but they didn't even realize what had happened until they were in that huge parade in downtown Chicago.
Yeah, everything happened so fast. That was the funny thing about the playoffs. You know, they swept Boston. They lost the first game to Anaheim, but then came back and won four straight. They had, I believe, 5 days off between the World Series. They won the World Series in a minimum amount of games in Houston and have to play the fifth game in Houston. They came back, and then 2 days later, this parade, it's like, boom, it happened so quick. And for Konerko, which I mentioned in the book, is that, you know, he and his wife had their first kid between the American League Championship Series and the World Series. So, does it get any better for a guy who's hits the game-winning homer or hits the grand slam in Game 2 to put him ahead and becomes a father for the first time 5 days earlier, wins his first World Series ever? And This is happening so quick. He's a free agent. He goes on to get a $60 million contract. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that.
Another player that's key to the history of the franchise and you know, one of the greatest ever is Frank Thomas. And after he put up a lot of great numbers, but he also was hurt a lot. And is he unfairly criticized for not playing due to some nagging injuries?
I think the injuries were more serious than really let on believe. You know, he's a big man. His foot injuries, that's a big thing with him. All the stress on his foot, also the arm, the biceps tears. Those were pretty serious injuries. I thought. And, you know, you can knock Frank for other things, you know, with the money situation and all that. But I think in regards to the injuries, he wanted to come back and play. He was just banged up. I think it'd be unfair to knock a guy for being hurt and accusing him of dogging it when he was really seriously hurt.
We're taking calls on the White Sox. If you'd like to throw a question in at Tribune reporter Mark Gonzalez, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We have a caller on from St. Charles on line four. Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Love the show. I'm glad you have a little sports thing here going. I was just wondering with the way the White Sox are this year, they probably won't make it, you know, and the same thing with the Cubs, but, you know, I think Ozzie Guillen gets too much of a bad rap. I like how he plays loose with his team. In fact, I think the Sox have a little bit more pizzazz than the Cubs. I think the Cubs are supposed to be the premier team, and for some reason, everybody happened to get in the last maybe decade doesn't produce like the Atu. It's like they come from another team, and you know, they're doing good then, and they come here and they do lousy. They go back to another team and they do better. And they retire there, you know. And I don't know. With the Sox, it seems like it is what it is. You know, scrappy, down-to-earth, you know, White Sox. You know, they beat the tar out of everybody. But I was wondering, do you think these guys are getting overpaid in some respect in general in baseball? Or, 'cause I look at it this way. I'm spending my hard-earned dollars to go to a game. And yet, you know, no matter who's playing, it just seems like it's getting more and more expensive. I'd rather sit at home and watch it on TV in my recliner, you know?
Well, I will say this. With the economy, I think it's going to force everybody to take a step back and assess things. You look at last year's free agent market, and there weren't too many guys that got big contracts. And I think the large majority of them, more so than past off seasons, had to take what the market was paying. And I think it might have been eye-opening to some players, but this is the reality. In regards to the players that might be overpaid now, you know, as long as owners are going to give them the contract, you know, why should they say no? I mean, it's just like entertainers get paid millions of dollars. It's all a matter of supply and demand, I think.
We got a couple more. Go ahead.
No, I'm both. I think it's crazy. I love all kinds of sports, okay? But I've kind of switched over to NASCAR a little bit more and to racing in general because they get paid contracts, and it's based on solely on the way they perform. And I keep thinking, why doesn't big sports do the same thing? And it's kind of, to me, it's, you know, it doesn't make sense to pay these guys these big contracts and go out in the field and not do good. You know, if you don't do good, if you're a lousy pitcher or a lousy catcher or can't hit, then, you know, bench you and you don't get paid. You know, you shouldn't. To me, I would say don't pay them for the days that they're off. You know, maybe that would produce people to be more enthusiastic about playing the ball. You know, because I've watched a couple of these movies in the past and put out with sports, you know, like The Natural and all that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's a matter of just cutting down the multi-year contracts and just going one year at a time to keep the carrot dangling.
Exactly. I mean, there's no enthusiasm out there anymore. Baseball, especially, it's just, I don't know, it gives a bad taste. They've been in strike so many times and, you know, unfair this and unfair that. I'm tired of them complaining. Just get on with the show. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. We've got a couple of our callers we want to move on to. Line one is on the U of I campus. Go ahead.
I want to go back to your comment about the Black Sox and being at the Hall of Fame. I think there was a news story about people once again trying to resurrect Shoeless Joe's standing in the game. Do you think, is this feasible? Could it be done? And if so, does it have any chance of actually succeeding?
I know there's a campaign going on for that. The one delicate issue, and we see it now with baseball, is as it relates to gambling with Pete Rose. Obviously, it's been a while, a long while, since the Black Sox scandal. I'm not sure how much zest there is in the commissioner's office to address this again and see if there is evidence that would allow Joe Jackson to get in the Hall of Fame, or, you know, if he wasn't involved as much as was documented. It's kind of a weird situation, because you'd have to go back a long way and really look under more rocks than normal. I'm not sure it would be feasible.
Thanks for your call. We have another caller on line two in Chatsworth. Go ahead.
Yes. Oh, I just had a comment. I've been a Sox fan since I've been a little kid. I'm 59 years old, and I've raised all three of my kids to be Sox fans, and we have gotten so much enjoyment out of them all these years. So I was wondering if you remember when Pearsall and Harry Carey started, how exciting those years were.
I mean, they were the show then. It was quite obvious, you know, the old line about Harry saying, "Jimmy, you're crazy," and Jimmy says, "Well, I got the papers to prove it."
Yeah, I remember that. And didn't Pearsall come from Texas, and they kind of hooked up together a little bit, and then the next year they hired Pearsall then?
Yeah, I know Jimmy worked in Oakland from his days with Charles Finley, and that kind of ended miserably. But Jimmy was very excitable and very entertaining and very informative with the A's until Charles O. Finley made him do a lot more things other than just being on the air for one or two innings.
Yeah, and plus he was always one guy that says, let's pay these players at the end of the year and how they perform, like your last caller was kind of alluding to.
Yeah, the one thing with that, though, you know, with free agency and such, and teams willing to lock up guys on long-term deals, it does give them some cost certainty. So that's one other consideration as to why some of these players get long-term deals. It also gives the fans a player to latch on to for more than just 1 year.
Yeah, I see. But the one thing I really hated to see was when Reinsdorf and Einhorn bought that team from Bill Veeck, and Harry defected to the north side, and now the Cubs get all the glory of Harry Carey.
Yeah, it was that was a tough time, especially since they had just bought the team. So that was really a kind of a step backward in that sense. But I think since then, Reinsdorf and Pearsall moved on, and certainly did to the Reinsdorf gang.
Yep. So, well, that was all my comment. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. We got one more. Line three in Urbana. Go ahead.
Yes. In discussing the White Sox of the late 1950s, you mentioned Landis and Rivera, and finally got around to Minoso and Aparicio, but I don't think you said anything about Fox or Sherm Lawler, who were probably the keys to that team.
Yeah, Fox was a big part of the 50s. Just a fabulous player. Just a guy, you know, you look at him and he got probably more out of his body than most players do with more talent. Just wonderful.
Almost never struck out.
Yeah, that's one thing that really stands out. He'd be a great fit on this team.
And what was it? He finished with a lifetime average of around 335 or something of that sort.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, Joe Morgan always refers to him as one of the players he always looked up to because of the fact that, you know, he just hardly struck out and was a guy who could do it all in terms of just, you know, adjusting to the situation.
Yeah, considering he was a fellow who couldn't make the pivot when he came up, I think he was only 18. He must have done a lot of work on that.
Yeah, he was a self-made player.
wouldn't even be considered today with his height and weight. But then Lawler is another that contributed a lot to that team. He was a great catcher.
Yeah, he was very dependable. That was an interesting time with him, especially going into the 59 season, and there was some thought that, you know, they probably hung on to him too long, but he was quite a serviceable player for them.
Well, thanks for writing about that about the team in the middle 90s, I guess, 1900s. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. We just got a couple of minutes left with Mark Gonzalez. I was just asking, maybe you have any parting thoughts looking ahead for next year. I like what I've seen when I do watch the Sox of Gordon Beckham. That was a big draft pick signing. And any thoughts on who else might make an impact next year or who might stay or leave the team?
Well, I think it's going to be a big year for Alex Rios. We certainly haven't seen what he's capable of doing since he came over. I think it's going to be a big offseason for him. If he can really rekindle the production he had in Toronto, I think the White Sox really got themselves a pretty good player. But I do expect some changes. I think there has to be after the way this team has struggled in the second half. But I think they're ahead of the curve in terms of getting younger, something they have to do, and I think it'll result in a more exciting team in 2010.
How does this compare? You've covered Barry Bonds. I mean, you talking about the steroid era, kind of comparing that to the Black Sox, but it has to be interesting that you were covering Bonds, I think, as a high school outfielder and then came, you know, found out what you did about him several years later.
Yeah, I just it's kind of funny because my last year covering the Giants was 1999, and that's like the first year Barry started getting bigger, and I was gone before the whole Balco debacle, but I did see him get abnormally bigger, put it that way.
Well, best of luck and continued success covering the White Sox, and really enjoyed having you on today.
Thank you. Thank you for the time, and all the best.
Same to you, Mark Gonzalez. His book is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Heart-Pounding, Jaw-Dropping, and Gut-Wrenching Moments from Chicago White Sox History. It's published by Triumph Books.